Welcome to the History of Chemistry podcast. I'm Steve Cohen, your host, and this is episode 112, Connect the Dots, about the discovery of quantum dots. Thanks to those who already support this podcast. Support the continuation of this podcast at Patreon. The website is www.patreon.com/thehistoryofchemistry. With the nanoparticle fad of the 1980s and 1990s going strong, let's look at another aspect of nanoparticles, quantum dots. The word quantum makes them seem somehow science fiction-y or mysterious, but no. This just means that their size affects their properties in a quantum mechanical way, and we shall see why. First, we recall the particle-in-the-box problem. I mentioned this in discussing confinement of electrons inside a ring of atoms on a surface, and how the corralling of electrons in the ring affected the electron's properties, creating an interference pattern, first seen in the 1990s as clear proof of a real-life particle-in-the-box, in this case, a round box. Back in 1937, German-British physicist Herbert Fröhlich, who fled the Nazi regime, as did so many Jews, considered the idea of how electrons' wavelengths would change in small metallic particles, depending on the size of those metallic particles. This would be a real-life case of a particle in a three-dimensional box, but here the box would resemble a ball. We can call this a quantum size effect. This was further studied by Japanese scientist Ryogo Kubo in the early 1960s. The general idea is that we imagine a nanoparticle of some semiconductor, in which we assume the electron is free to wander around in the valence band. Remember that semiconductors also have a conduction band at a higher energy. To get an electron into the conduction band, you have to pump it somehow, usually with a photon of light. Between the two orbital bands, there is a band gap where the electron's energy cannot exist. As the particle of semiconductor shrinks in size, from theoretical predictions like Fröhlich's particle-in-a-box treatment, we know that the band gap, the no-man's land between lower-energy-allowed electrons and higher-energy ones, increases. That means you need more and more energy to move the electron up into the conduction band as the particle shrinks, or you need less energy to do this as the particle grows. Perhaps another way to view the nanoparticle is this. The electron wave is bounded by the external orbital structure of the outermost atoms. The bigger the particle, the larger the electron wave can be. The smaller the particle, the smaller the electron wave is. Or, a bigger particle has electrons with less energy, and a smaller particle has electrons with more energy, because wavelength is the inverse of energy. So that's a simple introduction to a theoretical idea of a nanoparticle's quantum properties of its electrons. Do they exist in real life? We move forward to the late 1970s in the Soviet Union. A solid-state researcher, Alexei Yekimov in St. Petersburg, at the S.I. Vavilov State Optical Institute, wanted to study so-called colloidal particles that somehow affect the optical properties of glass. He was working with Alexander Efros. For example, since ancient times, glass artisans have used elements like gold, silver, and sulfur as additives to glass to obtain bright colors, as you can see in medieval stained glass windows. Precisely why was not understood, but it worked. Yekimov was interested more in this process. Colloids are large molecules mixed into another substance and dispersed throughout, for example, milk. Here we presumably have particles of gold mixed into glass. One practical application for this is making special optical filters, often called SHOTT, S-C-H-O-T-T, filters, that only allow certain wavelengths of light to pass through. Yekimov started research on these glasses with colloidal particles in 1979. Among the semiconductor compounds he decided to investigate in glass were copper chloride, copper bromide, cadmium sulfide, and cadmium senolide. The first one of these that worked properly, though, was copper chloride. He would add copper and chlorine to make tiny particles of copper chloride suspended in the glass. He heated the glass from 500 degrees Celsius to around 700 degrees Celsius for different lengths of time, anywhere from 1 hour to 96 hours, to let the copper chloride crystallize in the glass. He did X-ray crystallography to find crystals from 1.7 nanometers up to 31 nanometers across in the glass. Even more interesting was the absorption spectroscopy he measured on them. Bigger crystals of copper chloride absorbed redder light with longer wavelengths, while smaller crystals absorbed bluer light with shorter wavelengths. Yekimov realized the difference in absorption was a quantum effect, an actual observation of the particle-in-the-box problem. Yekimov was the first person to deliberately create quantum dots, though they weren't called that yet. His quantum dots, or microscopic crystals, as he called them, were trapped in glass and not isolatable. And yet, his results were viewed skeptically in the Soviet Union. Solid-state scientists were not ready to accept that these tiny crystals' optoelectronic properties were controlled by just one parameter, the diameter of the crystal. He published his observations in a Soviet journal, translated into English as JETP Letters, under the title Quantum Size Effect in Three-Dimensional Microscopic Semiconductor Crystals, in 1981. He used the word microcrystal to slide past the critical peer reviewers and editors of the journal. Meanwhile, there was independent interest in the West for semiconductors as a means to do some electrochemistry. So the idea was that maybe you could let a semiconductor absorb light near its band gap, get electrons and holes to jump up to the conduction band, and use those energetic charges to run electrochemical reactions. This could be useful for solar power, for example, or even convert methane to methanol, as my wife's research tried. So, some scientists were studying microcrystals of cadmium sulfide and titanium dioxide based on their band gaps. This led to a way to make colloidal quantum dots independently of Yekimov's work using a sol-gel process, which makes a solution slowly gel. This way, you can get the microcrystals out of the solution, a liquid, instead of a glass colloid. The American chemist, Louis Brus, was an employee of Bell Labs in the early 1980s and was studying photochemical reactions on cadmium sulfide particles. His synthesis of microcrystals of cadmium sulfide was done in a copolymer of styrene and maleic anhydride. The new colloid showed mostly 4.5 nanometer diameter cadmium sulfide particles. If he left the colloid out overnight, the particles redissolved and precipitated again, but larger, around 12.5 nanometers. Under Raman spectroscopy, the larger particles acted more like regular cadmium sulfide crystals, but the smaller, fresh ones absorbed at a higher energy, bluer color. Once again, we had quantum effects. Other semiconductors he tried were zinc sulfide, lead sulfide, zinc selenide, cadmium selenide, and various silver salts. He reported this in 1983. One anecdote about chemical safety, which I covered in a previous episode. To grow these tiny crystals, he had to connect toxic gases to his chemical labware. One time, Bruce managed to inhale some amount of hydrogen selenide gas because the regulator on the gas tank was defective. This put Bruce in the hospital overnight. Not until the following year did Bruce learn of Yekimov's work, and then he wrote to Yekimov to find out more of Yekimov's research. Apparently, this registered on the Soviet KGB's security radar, so they came to talk to Yekimov and his team. They weren't able to meet, however, until the Soviet Union experienced glasnost and perestroika in 1989. And by this time, the term quantum dot first appeared in print. In the Journal of Vacuum Science and Technology B in January 1986, a paper by Mark Reed and others from Dallas, Texas, called Spatial Quantization in Gallium Arsenide, Aluminum Gallium Arsenide Multiple Quantum Dots, was published, and the phrase stuck. But it seems this wasn't its first use. According to Louis Bruce, the Tunisian-American physicist who was a colleague of Bruce's at Bell Labs invented the phrase. The next question in the world of quantum dots was how to make them reliably. Up to this point, it was, quote, kind of a black magic, unquote, as Bruce has said. The Bell Labs team, now including American chemists Paul Alivisatos and Mike Steigerwald, spent much time testing various techniques, solvents, and heating, which requires a lot of human effort instead of remote-controlled spectroscopy. During the summer of 1987, a French-Tunisian-American chemistry graduate student, Moungi Bawendi, from the University of Chicago, came briefly to work with Bruce at Bell Labs and learned of quantum dots and their challenges. He finished his PhD the next year and returned to Bell Labs as a postdoctoral researcher to continue with quantum dots. The issue was, what exactly were the scientists making in their quest for reliable quantum dots? The team could get the dots in powder form out of the solution, but the dots were not good quality crystals. They got slightly better microcrystals if they heated them at about 90 degrees Celsius in pyridine, a benzene-like molecule with one nitrogen atom in the ring, substituting for one carbon atom. Pyridine has an intensely nasty smell, by the way. You'd think they are similar chemically because of only one change in one atom, but no, pyridine's nitrogen has a pair of unbonded electrons, like water has unbonded electrons. So it mixes nicely with water, whereas benzene doesn't so well. These unbonded electrons also act as a Lewis base, in that they grab onto protons, unlike benzene, which is pH neutral. Bawendi also learned that ethyl pyridine, also a Lewis base, heated at 160 degrees Celsius, helps make a bit better quantum dots too. So he thought and asked for every Lewis base in the team's laboratory and tried lots of those solvents. But no, that didn't work. Except one solvent did. Trioctyl phosphine, which has a central phosphorus atom attached to three chains of hydrocarbons, each with eight carbon atoms. Note that it also has unbonded pairs of electrons on the phosphorus atom. That solvent gave a quantum dot product of orangey-red color and fluoresced when ultraviolet light was shown on it. Then it was the end of December, and Bell Labs was shut for the winter holiday. In January, Bawendi returned and attempted to redo the experiment with trioctyl phosphine. But now it failed. Mike Steigerwald proposed an analysis of the solvent. Guess what? It reacted with the air to form trioctylphosphine oxide. Upon buying specially the oxide, he was finally able to reproduce the orange-red product. The original partially used bottle had some of the oxide mixed with the unoxidized solvent. By 1990, Bowendi's postdoctoral position was over, and he became a professor at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He continued the quantum dot studies with three initial students in his laboratory. Within a couple of years, he and his students figured out a reproducible method for making quantum dots of known sizes. Here is the way. Put the solvent into a flask, heat the flask, and inject reactants to make cadmium selenide. The concentration of the reactants saturates the solution near the injecting needle. This causes cadmium selenide to appear, but the dots wouldn't grow when the injected reactants cooled the solution a bit. So you raise the temperature of the solution, and the crystals grow more. The more you heat, the larger the crystals get. The crucial insight here was the starting point, the injection. Here you get what's called a nucleation event, a critical concentration that pushes the reactants to bond into nanocrystals. The crystals can have color from yellow all the way to red, depending on the size, which depends on how long you heat the flask. The smallest dots were 1.2 nanometers across and absorbed in the blue, or appeared yellow, and the largest dots were 11.5 nanometers across and absorbed mostly all light except for red, so appeared red. Their paper appeared in September 1993 in the Journal of the American Chemical Society. For their work, Yekimov, Bruce, and Bowendi jointly received the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 2023. Quantum dots are kind of a connection between individual atoms and molecules and everyday large-scale matter. In a way, they act like individual atoms because their electrons' energy levels are quantized into bands. Plus, because the electrons' orbitals are trapped into the small collections of atoms, scientists often call them zero-dimensional. The difference in color is not caused by different arrangements of atoms, it's caused by the number of atoms and therefore the particle's size. And the number of atoms could only be a few hundred up to a few thousand. So, are there any practical uses for these quantum dots? Because we are in the 1990s, we can discuss the first use for them was in biology laboratories. Biologists could tag living cells with different quantum dots that fluoresced with different colors. This was shown by Paul Alivisatos at Berkeley in a paper published in the journal Science in 1998. The quantum dots had to be modified for water solubility in living mouse cells. Almost simultaneously, Shumeng Nie at Indiana University in Bloomington did similar work. In our next episode, we examine a staple of 20th century toys, the chemistry set, and its history. Until then, brave the elements! Thank you for listening to the History of Chemistry podcast.